Across the Desk with Clement Manyathela on 702.
So on Across the Desk this morning, we've decided to host survey researchers. These are people that do our surveys, and I know you often have questions around their methodology. You've got questions about the kind of questions they ask when they're doing these surveys and research projects. And these are projects that are very instrumental in just getting the pulse of the nation on a number of issues. They help us just understand how people are thinking and where their mind is at in terms of certain political leaders, in terms of certain political parties. But they also do other work. It's not just on politics. I mean, they work on issues around infrastructure, around crime, around the cost of living, etc. So I want us to understand this morning what goes into their research. You know, when they come up with these polls and surveys, what's the kind of work that they do? If you've got questions, 011-883-0702, that's where you can give us a call. The WhatsApp line is 072-702-1702. We've got Ray Hartley, who is with the Brandhurst Foundation. He's a research director at the foundation. Ray, thank you for coming through. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
We also have Gabriel Markin, who's an associate at the Social Research Foundation. Gabriel, good morning.
Morning, Clement. Thank you so much for having me on.
We're also joined by Mary Harris, who is Ipsos's Sub-Saharan Africa Knowledge Director. Mary, thank you for making time as well. Good morning.
Good morning, and good morning, Ray and Gabriel.
So let's just start with the kind of, Ray, I'll start with you, the kind of methodology that you use at the Brandhurst Foundation.
Yeah, okay, so I don't actually conduct surveys myself. Mm. We use a company called Sabi Strategy, and they're based in London, and they have given us their methodology, which I can summarize for you. Mm. So essentially, it's a random phone call method, so by cell phone. Mm-hmm. So there's very high cell phone penetration in South Africa. Your chances of hitting any demographic are pretty good.
Yeah.
But to sort of make it more accurate, it is then weighted according to gender, mm-hmm. Age, and province, so that there's a proper spread of voters across the country and so on. Because you might find in a random sample that you get a disproportionate number of people from a smaller province, mm-hmm. and a larger province, and you don't want to skew the result with that. Mm. So that gets weighted. We only confine ourselves to registered voters with the intention to vote, so that you actually get, you know, people who are likely to be voting.
How do you establish that? Do you ask them if they've registered?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we also ask them about their voting in the previous election, which gives you an idea if they mm-hmm. are, you know, active participants. It's a 15-minute questionnaire, so it's done in person. Goes on for some time.
Actually have 15 minutes to spare to take some questions.
You'd be surprised. South Africans love to express their views, you know, as you know.
Yeah.
And with the correct approach from professionals who are trained in this, they do respond.
Yeah.
So that's our thing. We have a sample of 1,506 for this latest survey. We aim for 1,500.
Okay, you'll tell us more about the survey in a moment. Do you ever do face-to-face, or is it just you confined to telephonic?
No, we just do the telephonic.
Okay.
So there's a different kind of survey methodology, which the experts that are on the line could describe better, where you get some quality.
Gabriel, what about you guys at the Social Research Foundation? How do you go about the polls? What kind of methodology do you go with?
So very similar to Ray. We don't outsource to the exact same company. We outsource to a company called Victory Research. But they conduct telephonic interviews. We don't confine ourselves to a kind of any length of script, and I'm sure that Ray and Brentus don't either. But we generally have found, generally have done 20 to 25 minute long scripts, because we have been very interested in all of the polls that we're doing, given that we are newer to the scene than both Brenthurst and Ipsos, and kind of seeing what our kind of niche in public opinion polling could be. But in terms of any kind of methodological differences between Ray and our work, it's very much the same: telephonic interviews, random sample, and waiting to ensure that the results aren't skewed by any outliers.
And Mari, how about you guys at Ipsos?
We do quite a variety of studies. We do qualitative work that involves in-depth interviews. Those are only for specialized projects. And then we also do the CATI work that both Ray and Gabriel were talking about. That is the telephonic interviews, where the sample is drawn on a probability basis and you do the interviews over the telephone. However, we will never do a CATI interview that's longer than 20 minutes, because people sort of lose interest after that time. And then we do face-to-face interviews, where we go out, we have, we draw a sample of the whole country, all provinces, all types of settlements, even in deep rural areas, and do the interviews face-to-face in the homes and in the home languages of respondents. We do that at least twice a year, not only in election years, but in every year. And therefore, we have quite a history of a built-up history of results and what people are saying. Obviously, when results come back, whether it's been done on computer, face-to-face on the computer, or whether it's been done by CATI, that's the telephone interviews, we also wait the results and, you know, report on what the South African population are saying.
Yeah. And what are they saying now, Ray, with your latest study? What have you been able to establish about particularly the big political parties and maybe some of the new entrants as well and their political leaders?
Well, it's amazing how fluid the situation is. I think that's the first thing. So I think we were the first survey that came in after the formation of MK Party. And wow, I mean, they're the dominant party in KwaZulu-Natal. Well, I say dominant, 25%. And then the IFP, DA, et cetera, are in the 20s, 19s. That was
quite something, hey, for a new party to come in and I mean, already do so well on the ground in terms of surveys. I mean, you look at the by-elections as well. Their presence is felt there.
I think there's this, there are quite a few factors behind that. I would say one of them is that the face of MK in everyone's mind is Jacob Zuma, whether or not he's on the ballot paper. And he's a highly recognizable figure and has a very prominent place in KwaZulu-Natal. I think if you go back historically, you know, credit must be given where credit's due. Jacob Zuma was the one who stepped out of the ANC's sort of straitjacket and went into KwaZulu-Natal, was willing to get his roll up his sleeves and sort out the violence that was racking that province between the IFP and the ANC. And it's quite a remarkable achievement what happened there over those years. And I think that sat very well with people. And when he, you know, in the, when he became president in 2008, I must get my numbers right. There was an interesting statistic there, because the ANC dropped support in 8 of the 9 provinces, but it went up very dramatically in KwaZulu-Natal with him as candidate. So that showed that there's a base there that is quite loyal to him. And I think that's, if you look at this survey and you see how the ANC has declined and the IFP has declined and how MK has come in at 25% in that province, it's reigniting that old base. And it's to do also with dissatisfaction with the way the province is going, because there have been multiple crises, and some of them are weather-related and not really in the political space, but others are to do with the, you know, the unrest and so on that occurred. So there is some credibility, I think, to that, to Zuma making that surge in KZN.
Okay. So the MK party, on your latest research, you are seeing that the party is what? Is it going to be the biggest, from what you're reading, the biggest party in KwaZulu-Natal, or is it slashing the ANC support?
Yeah, it's going to be the biggest. It's got 25, and 25. The others are in the 20s sort of territory.
Whoever thought?
Yeah.
My goodness.
So that's fascinating. And you know, it could be a surge that occurred, mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of hype around MK around the time we were doing the survey.
Mm-hmm.
In February, they were the national news story. And, you know, so the thing about polling is that it's a snapshot of the time where it's done.
Mm.
So right then, the dominant national news story was Zuma's back. He's got a party. Is the IEC going to approve? They've applied.
Mm.
He wants to be on the ballot paper. There's threats of violence if this, that, and the other. Mm. It was the national political story.
So timing is everything.
So it could be that there was a surge there, which might drop off a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And Gabriel, as the Social Research Foundation, do you have a recent kind of a survey that has indicated something about, you know, the dominant players now?
We are actually days away from receiving our baseline national survey. So what we are planning on doing and what we are going to be doing is from about, I think it's the 18th of April, so we'll get this national baseline survey in, and then from about the 18th of April, every day, we're going to conduct 200 new interviews and remove from our sample the 200 oldest interviews.
Mm.
And by doing so, we'll do that every day for 6 weeks up until the day before the election. And by doing that, we'll be able to create a moving average of the different political parties as a means of really maintaining in the public view, just like they do in developed democracies, a large scale, high quality tracking poll to see, you know, how does it fluctuate on the day to day basis. Our most recent work that we've done were two provincial surveys, small provincial surveys at the start of this year.
Mm-hmm.
I think previously we'd actually had a conversation, you and I, Clement, about our survey of KZN, which showed that, just like Ray was saying, MK looks set to become the largest party. And then we did a survey of the Western Cape, and the kind of headline from that is we saw what might be a small downward shift for the DA and a small upward shift for the ANC. But really nothing so dramatic. As Ray was pointing out, the really big story that has shifted most of what we thought before the end of last year about the political situation in the country is the reintroduction of Jacob Zuma through the Umkhonto weSizwe party.
Yeah. And Mari, at Ipsos, any from the most recent survey, what is it indicating?
Well, I have to agree with the two gentlemen that the biggest story is definitely MK, and it changed the marbles on the board. Mm-hmm. Things changed after the introduction of MK. It will be very interesting to see what the outcome of the court cases are. But I think the major issue in this election will be whether people will go out and vote, what the turnout will be. Because in a lot of studies we've done and modeling we've done, the lower the turnout, the more it favors the ANC. So if people do not turn out to vote, only the very loyal ANC supporters and those in the rural areas turn out to vote, or a majority of them turn out to vote, the ANC will do quite well. We do think the ANC will be under 50% all over the country. One thing I want to say is that the dominant players in the different provinces do differ. You have to look at the provincial scene and not only at the national scene, because the story is slightly different in every province, and you have to be sensitive to the provincial issues. Mm. And then about by-elections, just one remark. They can be very important. But on the other hand, a lot of times by-elections are used to express a protest vote. Yeah. If you are fed up with the government and you are fed up with all the potholes in your area and there's a by-election in your area, regardless of your party loyalties, chances are you're going to vote against the government. Because in a by-election, it's a very safe thing to do, to vote against the party that you really support or the party that's in power. So by-elections are not a good predictor. You always have to think about what were the circumstances.
Hmm. What kind of questions do you ask, Ray, when people are calling us? And I must say, please do tell the people to call me, because I've never been called for a survey and anybody was asking me about where I'm leaning towards.
Your chances are not very good, by the way.
Oh dear. I've always looked forward to one day receiving that call. In fact, I'm receiving the DA's telemarketing calls more than anything else. So Ray, let's look at those questions that you often ask. Like, because often people say, yeah, sometimes the polls frame the questions in a particular way because they want the outcome to be a particular way. How do you go about deciding how to frame those questions?
Yeah. So, the main question about the overall result, the national and provincial result, is, and I can literally read it to you, thinking ahead to the next general election, which party will you vote for?
Okay.
So, I'm not sure if it's possible to read into that any kind of particular desire for a particular outcome. I think it's as neutral as you can possibly make it. Mm. So it's not like, you could frame a question that says, opposition parties are on the rise. Would you consider voting for them rather than the ANC? And then have another question which says, which party are you voting for? Mm. So you're kind of herding the person who's answering in a particular direction. So we start cold with a very neutral question like that, and try to keep it as neutral as possible. We do also ask a lot of policy and other sort of related questions later on, but that's after the main polling survey, so that those things don't influence your answer to the big question, who you're going to vote for, but are rather about your views on, I don't know, Ukraine, Russia, or things like that. We ask foreign policy questions and so on.
Yeah. How do you work, Gabriel, with the political parties? Because some parties will often approach you guys to do a particular survey for them. And there's always going to be questions around your leanings towards the party. I mean, if they're paying, or there's a media agency that's paying for you to do that kind of survey, does that in any way influence how you go about doing the work and what the outcome possibly is?
Well, first of all, no political party has ever paid for us to do a survey for them. And we wouldn't accept any money from any political party to do surveys for them. We were funded by a handful of donors who they give us the capital necessary to fund all of our survey work throughout the year. But we do, with that being said, we do go to see to share our results with any political party that will talk to us. And I'm sure, Clement, you might be hinting at that there are certain political parties that do not maybe think that our polling is entirely neutral and fair. Mm. But I'd say to them, what public opinion changes on the daily basis. If you aren't seeing in our polls the results that you think you are deserving of, maybe you're not working hard enough to get those results. Mm. You know, using the methodology that we do, it's very difficult to kind of distort the results. As you point out there, and as Ray kind of gave a good example of, you can influence and skew results by wording questions in ways. But a lot of the time what I've found is that when we do have questions that lead people in a certain direction, what we will inevitably do is ask a similar question, but then kind of leading you in the opposite way. You know, Ray mentioned foreign policy, and I think that's a very good example of where it becomes very difficult to not have the questions influence the outcomes, because for example, we asked a question which is, should South Africa side with the US and the West or with Russia and China?
Mm.
And when posed kind of as a binary, most people went with Russia and China, like the plurality, not a majority, mm. but plurality. But mm. then we asked people kind of two questions down, is it in the best interests of South Africa to form close relationships with the West and the United States? And then the vast majority of South Africans agreed that it was important for South Africa to form close relationships with the West and the US. And so I think what this kind of points to is not so much that the... It is true that the questions can lead and can distort the way that people think about their answers, but mm-hmm. it's also true that when there isn't when you don't have a definitive view on the question you're being asked, you're probably going to answer it in the way that you think is kind of suggested, the correct way that it's suggested to you.
Yeah.
But you'll find that people will answer with completely diametrically opposed views and believe in both of them. And that's great, because it teaches us something about human beings, which is everyone at all the time holds paradoxical views, and mm-hmm. we mm-hmm. just go about keeping on going despite the paradoxes, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah.
And which is a good sign. If you get results like that, it's a good sign that you're working with human beings, because we're incredibly complicated and difficult to understand.
Yeah, and Mari, the same question about working with political parties and dealing with often questions about political leanings and veracity. How do you deal with that at Ipsos?
Mm-hmm. Well, very much the same as the other organizations. What we do when we ask the question about which party would you vote for, our question is very much the same as Ray's, very cold, neutral, but we ask, if there were an election tomorrow, which party or organization would you vote for? We ask that question when we do CATI interviews, that's the telephonic interviews, and when we do CAPI, which are the computer-assisted interviews, face-to-face interviews. We also use another technique in the face-to-face interviews, where we give people a ballot paper. We used that for the first time in 1994 in KZN, because you would not remember that there was a lot of unrest and violence between the IFP and ANC in KwaZulu-Natal that year. And it was very dangerous to say out loud who you would vote for. So we devised a ballot paper that looks exactly like the IEC ballot paper. And people could then draw their own crosses. They sealed their ballot. Obviously, at that stage, we didn't do it on computer. They sealed their ballot paper and give it back to the interviewer. These days, we give the computer to the person and say, I don't really want to know who you're going to vote for, but if there were an election tomorrow, who would you vote for? Please give an indication on this. So we try and emulate a secret vote. first of all. And then as far as political parties are concerned, I would be very worried if political parties always agreed with you.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing if they disagree with you, because in the end, you cannot comply with what they want. And usually the biggest criticism comes from those who have a bone to pick, first of all, or they have, you know, they don't agree, or they...
Yeah, because if you told them 60% of people are going to vote for you, I mean, who's going to complain?
Exactly. Exactly. But if you say 2% are going to vote for you, they're bound to have an opinion about that.
Yeah.
So I do think you sometimes have to take the opinions with a pinch of salt.
Yeah.
But I think the best way is to do it in an honest way and to do it with integrity.
Yeah. It's 10:32.
Across the Desk with Clement Manyathela on 702.
It's 22 minutes before 11 o'clock on our Across the Desk feature this morning. We're hosting survey researchers. We've got the Brandtest Foundation. We've got Ipsos. We've got the Social Research Foundation as well. I want to go to your calls now and your WhatsApps. I see some questions that are coming through, some texts as well. So I'll start with a message from Tabiso from Centurion, who is asking, hey, Clement, please can you ask your guests how the margin of error is calculated on their surveys? Ray?
Wow. Okay. That's a deep technical question, which I'm sure Sabi could answer better than I could.
Yeah.
But essentially, the lower the number of people you interview, the higher the margin of error. So the possibility that the survey is off beam is greater the fewer that you interview.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important for any survey to state what they believe the margin of error is on that survey.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Can I add to that?
Yes, you can.
Can I just quickly add to that? It and the margin of error depends on your sample size, not on the size of your universe. It's very important to remember that. It depends on your sample size, the methodology that you have used, and your response rate. Between those three, you calculate the margin of error. And as Ray said, it is a very technical calculation to do, but a very, very necessary one.
Mm-hmm. You want to add that, Gabriel?
Yes, and I guess one of the kind of important things that maybe people don't really understand about surveys and the technicalities that go into the margin of error is that you always calculate margin of error at what is known as a confidence level. At the SRF, we do it at the 95% confidence level, which essentially says that it's not this exact idea, but basically that there's a 5% chance that the sample that we have interviewed is not representative at all, and all of our findings are completely off base. There's, in every survey that's ever done, there is the chance that pays out. And so that's, you have to, when you're calculating margin of error, you are also calculating it based on an assumption, which is not, we are like kind of, it's not the exact idea, but 95% of the time, this is a representative sample, and this does show us something about the country, but about 5% of the time, this could be completely off base.
Okay.
It's not an exact science.
Mm, yeah. Let's go to the WhatsApp voice note.
Clement, good morning. Jabu speaking here. I would like to ask your guests as to what extent have they missed the mark in the previous polling? Have they missed the mark from the actual election outcomes?
Morning, Clement. Could you ask your guests with these political questions that they ask and the questionnaires, do they sometimes put the question in or the option in for the respondent to be able to say, I don't know? For instance, when it comes to foreign policy and who should South Africa align themselves to? Some people may not have a strong view, or they may not understand what it's about. Is there an option then that they can ask, I don't know? Thank you. It's Louise from Cape Town.
Good morning, Clement, and a good morning to your guests. Very interesting topic. My question is there a tool or instrument that is used by these companies to reduce bias when questions are asked in a survey or on a ballot form or interviews or however they conduct, they get their information? What kind of standardized, valid, reliable tool do they use to make sure that there isn't bias when questions are asked? And if there's someone specific who maybe is responsible, or a certain group of people within their organizations who ask these questions or who formulate these questions, what structure is put in place to make sure that the questions are fair and neutral? Thank you. Kia from Pretoria.
Good day, Clement. I have heard one of your guests saying that they had a sample of 1,500. But don't they think that in a heterogeneous society like ours, a sample of 1,500 is very small? Because that 1,500 might be around Sandton and surrounding areas, but it won't cover the whole country. Don't they think that such sample might be misleading? Thanks, David.
Thank you, David. Let me also take this one. A call from Mark in Johannesburg. Mark, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was surprised to hear from your two guests who do many...
Mark, I'm not happy with that line. I'm going to put you back to the producers. Let's try and rectify it. I'm really struggling to hear you. So let's deal with the four questions that have come through. Someone wanted to know about, have you missed the mark before where this is what you predicted, but then the election results come through and you realize, oh my goodness, we are so far from what the outcome is. And is there an option of, I don't know, in when you do your surveys? And then do you have a tool that is used to reduce bias when questions are asked? You know, what standardized tool is used to ensure no bias? And the last question was around your sample, the 1,500. The listener says that's very small and that could be in a geographical location and that could be misleading. Let's start with you, Ray. You can pick what you want to answer and then give Gabriel and Mari an opportunity to respond to others as well.
Yeah, I think that we... definitely confident in the 1,500 with the 3% margin of error, and as was said, on a 95% confidence level. So,
is the 1,500 normally in just one area or spread across?
It's spread across the country. So we interview people from everywhere. We have results coming in from all provinces, cities, major areas, but then it is weighted to remove any possible bias against a particular geography or age or gender so that it conforms to the South African demographic. So that's probably about as, you know, as close as you can get to getting it right. The interesting question about, you know, can people say, I don't know, or I don't want to answer it, or it's definitely the case. South Africans are very opinionated, though, so it's always a few, a low number of people who say, I don't know, or I don't have an opinion. I mean, we asked, for example, about the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and 52% of people said it made no difference. It's interesting on foreign policy, the majority of people say it makes no difference to their decision to vote, but only 7% of people would be, not having an opinion. It's very low. It's quite interesting that, and I'm not sure if it's the same for the other companies, but it does show. You know, South Africans kind of know what they think.
Gabriel,
I think I would agree with Ray in that, you know, generally we also always have the option for don't know, or you can even refuse to just answer the question, stay silent, or whatever. I think that what we have encountered on foreign policy questions is that is where people will say, I don't know. And a lot of the time, though, it's kind of just about the way you, which way you lean, because we've done a lot of work just pitching a kind of the Eastern Bloc, China, Russia, versus the West, and just seeing which side South Africans favor. And then I thought that there's this kind of trend that the question that the woman from Pretoria asked in about bias and the way that we try to reduce bias is because I think that there's a misunderstanding in even the way that question is phrased, because it is simply impossible in the research that we're doing to avoid bias at all. Like there's no way, but the bias that we do that does creep into the surveys is not the bias that people think I would generally assume is the kind of this bias of trying to lead the results to go in some way or something like that, but it's the bias of, for example, let's say you want to do a face-to-face surveys, and you're doing your face-to-face surveys during the working hours during the week, you might then undersample your working voters, and what that then introduces a huge amount of bias into your survey, because you've undersampled a very important part of the population, but that isn't that has at no point meant that you've put a malicious effort to bias and change the results to direct them in some way. What it means is just that doing this kind of research is complicated, and it is never possible to conduct a perfect survey. And given the nature of the subject, you know, the human being and human opinion, which is infinitely difficult to understand, There is no way that you can kind of reduce or remove all bias. The best thing that you can kind of do is be aware of the potential for bias to creep into your survey, and always when looking at results, never focus on the individual numbers, but look at the trends that present themselves within the survey, and always be aware that the margin of error is a good indication of how quote-unquote biased your survey is.
Okay. And Mari?
Well, just to go on with the bias and just a remark on how we reduce bias on a face-to-face study. In a face-to-face study, the interviews will be done either in the evenings or late afternoon and over weekends. So we try and avoid the hours when people are working. So, and then secondly, there is, because we do our own field work, we have a department that checks absolutely every step of the way. And 20% of each interview is being back-checked. So there's a lot of checks and balances in this whole thing. It is not just for going out and ask a few people a few questions. It is a very organized scientific process to get the results that you want in the end. And when you use the same question, like we spoke about the question that all of us use when asking about which party people would vote for, you use the same question every time. And you can then see that it works. Tried and tested. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
And I think that all the other questions are answered except the one about missing the mark.
Yes.
Since 1994, we haven't missed the mark with more than 2% on of the big parties. Some of the smaller parties, it's very difficult to predict. It's always also has to do with the margin of error. Remember, I said to you, it depends on the sample size. And the sample size of those answering for a very small party is a smaller number. People who answer for that party. So that specific party's margin of error, it not only matters that it we have an overall margin of error, but there's also a margin of error per province and per party. So you can do a lot of things and further delving into the margin of error. It's an absolutely very complicated issue, like Ray said. But it's more difficult to predict a small party than a big party.
Okay.
I wanted to jump in because I remembered that I had an answer to one of the questions about 1,500 being too small. Mm. A very good website and tool to use for anyone who's interested in the US elections is the website Real Clear Politics. And you could go on to the Real Clear Politics polling average. And you'll see, even in the United States, a country with about 5 times larger population than ours, a survey of 1,500 people is considered standard and a good size, and you get the kind of same margin of error in the US on 1,500 people as you do in South Africa. And so it is, the sizes that we're talking about, they may sound small, but they are accepted as being able to produce a representative sample.
Mm-hmm.
There's a classic case that you can go and have a look at. George Gallup did it in 1947, where he interviewed 1,000 people over the states and predicted the next president of the United States correctly, whereas I think it was the New York Times, something like 3 million readers writing into the newspaper saying who they think will be the next president. And they were wrong. Yeah. Although they had more than 3 million possible voters answering, it's not in the number. It is in how mind. That's the important part.
Mm-hmm. Let's just take the last round of questions.
Hi, Clement and your guests. Just a quick one from my side. Is it possible for them to also use the likes of, you know, Fourth Industrial Revolution to kind of speculate also? I mean, I do understand that the survey is based on what the population would have answered, but can they also, or have they also thought of how they could use previous data to kind of speculate the result? Like maybe using ChatGPT, you know, your AI. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. We got a call earlier for Mark, but that line was deteriorating, but he gave us his question. He wanted to know, does the fact that you do not weigh samples by race not affect the surveys, considering South African race relations? That's a question from Mark there. And then the last one I'll ask is around the links to some political parties. For instance, the Brentes Foundation, the links to the Oppenheimer family or the Social Research Foundation. When you look at the director having been with the Institute of Race Relations, which Helen Ziller was part of, does that in any way sometimes impact on the credibility of the surveys that you produce as the foundations? Ray, let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a valid question, because you would say, well, this institution gets its funding from so-and-so, and are they not influenced?
Who funds the DA and Action SA and this and that?
But I think it's fallacious. I think it's completely wrong, because firstly, you know, who would put their credibility on the line for some political party to look good in a poll and then to be shown to be wrong when the outcome of the election occurs? Mm. I think that's the first thing. And the second thing is, I think there's a big misconception out there that polls can influence voters. Mm-hmm. So if you show that the DA is rising, it's going to lead to more DA votes. Mm. This is completely wrong. I mean, I give you two recent examples. Donald Trump, all the polls showed he was losing. He won.
Yeah.
Brexit, again, and I'm talking about two examples from sophisticated polling, you know, countries where there's lots of polling.
Yeah.
They all showed the wrong result. So it could be even that there is the opposite occurring, that when a party is shown to be low, it galvanizes them and forces them to be more active and to try and rescue the situation. And it may make a higher scoring party complacent.
Yeah. And Gabriel, let's do with you. We've got about a minute left. If we can just keep it short, the responses.
I'll try my best to. I agree with Ray. I think that it would be. I understand where the reasoning can come in, that you worry about who's influencing these results. But you know, as Ray said, we're putting our credibility on the line here by putting out these numbers. From the moment that the Social Research Foundation started releasing numbers, we have evidence for people to go back to after the election to point at and say either we were right or wrong. And as Ray pointed out, it's not so simple as if a poll shows that, for example, the DA is growing, that must be good for the DA. In fact, it could, as Ray suggested, be the exact opposite, that if you show growth in a party, the supporters get complacent and they don't show up.
Yeah.
But polls, the idea that polls can influence the electorate has the reasoning literally backwards, in my opinion. It's a reflection of what people believe. It isn't a way to change the beliefs of people.
Yeah. And then the question about AI?
Then the question about AI, I mean, you know, yes, I'm sure there's lots of ways to integrate it and to find out pieces of and bits of information nested in our data that might be useful. As to whether we will do that, sure, but we have a 6-week tracking poll to get through before I can start to think about stuff.
All right, like Mari, we've got about 30 seconds. Your turn.
Okay, two things quickly on Fourth Industrial Revolution and on AI. We do use the data we get for modeling sometimes and use very sophisticated techniques to see what we get. But the big thing is about, so do not believe everything you read on social media. It's not representative. And the big thing about try and be as representative as possible. And I'm sure the two gentlemen will agree with me that social media is not one of the representative instruments that we can use. And weight by race, it depends how, what figures you have. We usually weight within province by sex, age, race, working status, and a lot of other criteria. The link to political parties, Ipsos is an independent organization like the others are. And the big thing for us is, like the Brain Test Foundation and like the SRA, it's our reputation that's on the line. We need to be transparent. We need to be independent.
All right. Ray Hartley from the Brain Test Foundation, Mari Harris from Ipsos, and Gabriel Mackin from the Social Research Foundation. Thanks for all of you for making time for us this morning.